Welcome to another week of Mwango Spaces. So here we're having a discussion about the Absa Kenya Financial Year 2023 results. The results were released yesterday. Very impressive results all around. We want to dig deep into the numbers. And if you have any questions, we'll be welcoming them later in the spaces. So we have around an hour to do this. And next to me as a co-host is Rona. Maybe Rona, you can say hi.
Good evening, everyone.
And then now we have Yusuf, who's our main guest. So Yusuf, make an introduction for those who don't know you.
Thank you. And good evening to everyone. My name is Yusuf Omari. I'm the finance director for Absa Bank of Kenya. Really glad to be here.
All right. Yusuf, maybe just on a light note, you can give us a bit of a brief background on how you got to become the CFO of Absa Kenya. What's your journey there been like?
Thank you for that. I think a long journey, starting right from when I joined one of the big audit firms, that's KMG. Worked there for several years, and then I joined Barclays then, the manager in internal audit, within a short build of the head. So the internal audit director. And then after doing about 5-6 years there, I moved to be a compliance director for the bank, really helping me on the regulatory space with, of course, CBK at that point in time. And then after that, then I moved to become the finance director. So I've been a finance director all through now. And last year, I've been a stint as the acting CEO for Absa. I think that's a brief.
Thank you so much, Yusuf. We'll go deep down into the numbers now. We'll start with a broad overview. So maybe you can give us a bit of a flavor on how the earnings looks like. What are the key things and key numbers that stood out for you in the FY 2023 results for Absa Kenya?
Yeah, I think some good results we released recently, with the key driver of that is balance sheet. You notice that in bank, the balance sheet drives a big chunk of revenue, which is our net interest income. So we grew our loans and advances by about 18% during that period. And that was funded through deposit growth of 19%. So literally deposit funding the assets, to be precise, 59 billion shillings growth in deposits, and lending in absolute figure at 18% is about 53 billion. So really trying to balance loan to deposit ratio from that perspective. And in here from the balance sheet, you find now the revenue picking up during this reporting period. Year-on-year revenue growth of about 19%, and a big chunk of it really comes from net interest income, which is the balance sheet that I mentioned. Cost picking up year-on-year 16%, big investments in staff cost and other operating costs, mainly touching on investments in technology. So you see a positive jaw, revenue 19% up with cost 16%, so a positive jaw about 3%. And then on the impairment side, impairment picking up year-on-year by about 43%. But really the important figure on impairment is the loan loss ratio. So loan loss ratio about 2.8%. And then with that, then profit after tax during this period is what we reported yesterday, a 12% growth in profit after tax. Subsequent to that, the board recommended a dividend payout of 1.35, which combining with the total interim dividend, the total dividend for the year 2023 then was 1.55 per share, which is a 15% from the previous year.
Rona, do you have a question there? Maybe you can start off in terms of the numbers that you just gave to us.
Sure. Thanks for that very good summary of the results. Like you said, the key driver for the bank's revenue was the balance sheet. So maybe that's a good place to start. You indicated that the loan book grew by about 18%. Could you just maybe give us a breakdown of what the real growth number was if you adjust or FX depreciation? That's one. And the second one is an interesting trend we noticed amongst what I would call all the multinational banks, Absa, Stanbic, Standard Chartered, is that all the banks reduced exposures to government securities. Could you maybe just talk us through what the thinking there was? And given recent developments around the appreciation of the shilling, maybe interest rates starting to peak, has that strategy now changed? I.e., would you now be seeking to increase exposures once again, or are you comfortable at current levels?
Thanks so much, Ronald, for that set of questions. So depreciation, which is really of the local currency, accounted for about 7 billion shillings of our growth. So from the 53 billion, then you'll be able to say around 344 is the number we ended up. So if we ring fence that, then the 18% goes down to 15%. So still double-digit growth rates in lending, even after taking into consideration the FX impact. So that's basically what we call constant currency. If I look at investment in government security for the bank, you'll see that our investment came down year on year from a high of about 90 billion in government security to about 73 billion. And in here, several reasons. One is the fact that we have supported lending to the sector. So really more exposed on lending as an investment asset, as opposed to the government security. And secondly, also is while you see a drop in government security, if you go to the details of the financials, you'll see the interest income coming from government security has actually picked up. So really in there, you'll be able to see when the government securities were maturing, we're able to invest in high yielding papers, hence uplift. So that's really the logic on this investment in government security.
Maybe just a follow-up to this question of government securities. The conversations I've had with some of your peers, multinational peers, is that they have a limit imposed on them from the group level in terms of the exposure that they could have with the Kenyan government. Does APSA have similar limitations as well from the group, or you could potentially have as much exposure to government securities as you like, depending on where we are with the yields and all that sort of thing?
We don't have limits imposed on us on all these investments. Of course, we can't expose ourselves significantly. If you look at our total investment in government security during this period, you say it's around 15% of our total balance sheet. That figure can oscillate all the way to, say, 25% of the total assets. I think, to be honest, what we are managing there is interest rate risk and also, of course, the tenor of these investments, just to make sure that we don't have a mismatch. If you look at that year under question, we saw volatility in the interest rates. So it's very important during that time to know when to exit and when to come back. Otherwise, you find yourself with government security with rates of, say, 14%, 12%. When compared to today, you see the rates are now at 17, 18. So you can imagine the mark-to-market loss that you would have incurred if you did not churn the book. So this is more of a precautionary measure that we took. In such an environment, you don't want to be long on some of these papers. But then once you see that the stability of the interest rates, then you can be able to come in. You recall last year, the government did quite a number of tap sales, both in bonds and bills. And every time these sales were happening, the rates were actually going up. And so banks and fund managers, pensions, they had to respond to this, to be tactical when to come in, just to make sure that you're not recording mark-to-market losses.
So perhaps some of the key things that you talked about in your earnings also is something to do with the NPLs. So we can give us a bit of perspective. There was a bit of an increase in NPLs and provisioning. So maybe you can give context to those numbers in the context of an economy that is just half on business in the past year.
I think, to be honest, in a year where you're having this kind of macroeconomic environment, the expectation is that in the entire industry, you should be able to see increase in impairment. And for the simple reason that, number one, the macroeconomic tables or overlay that will come because of the fact that there is instability in the macroeconomic environment dictates that you take provision. So these are the forward-looking provisions. In our number here, we had about nearly a billion shillings. In size, it's about 900 million shillings. That had nothing to do with name-specific or portfolio-specific impairment, but purely driven because of the macro conditions at that point in time. There is a provision that will always pick under IFRS 9, where if your book picks up, automatically you take impairment. This is under stage one. So 18% growth in lending dictates that your impairment must pick up just from that. And then the third reason is, of course, being a tough environment, we saw strains coming from our different customer segments. Corporate and business banking customers, especially the importers, were affected significantly with the FX situation, because it meant their inputs were more expensive. And if they could not be able to pass that cost, then it meant some strain in their ability to repay the loan. In their inflation, also checking in, and of course, the availability of dollars, again, for the importers. Personal household, including SMEs, impacted with all those reasons that I've mentioned. But then an additional impact coming from inflation, especially for individuals because of the fiscal measures, the finance bill, introduction of new taxes, or rather higher rates, that had an impact. So those are the reasons why we saw our loan loss ratios picking up. On the NPL, it picked up well, although still significant. significantly below the industry level. Not if you look at our NPL ratio at around 9.6, the industry is nearly 15%. We're still better than what we are seeing in the industry, but still we got a strain during this time. And the main areas were in manufacturing, in food, and then of course in personal, household, and SMEs as well.
You just did speak a bit about preference for short-term lending, especially from customer, and something also preference also especially for overdrafts, bank overdrafts. So maybe you can give a bit of a flavor on what you're observing among your customers and how the economy is impacting them.
I think the logical thing during an environment like this is not to go loan long on your borrowing and by long tenors. You don't want to pick, for example, a fixed rate for say 5, 8, 10 years, because then you're locking a very high rate today, maybe even 20%. And we know this current macroeconomic condition, if the stability on inflation continues, the reflections we've been able to see on the strengthening of the Kenya shilling, if this continues, then we'll be able to say maybe we've maxed out on the interest rates, and so it can only come down. Now, you don't want to then be long on your tenors. So the logical thing for where we saw a customer head is to avoid what you call luxurious debt, and luxurious buying a house, buying household items, etc. And then that basically then meant most of the exposure were to do with businesses. And even with the businesses, preference was more to do with trade-related kind of facility and to just finance the working capital, also a preference for overdraft. On the personal sector, taking short-term loan, tenors of maybe like a month, 3 months, 6 months to 1 year, that is where we saw a lot of interest, which then means you just paid for the rates. It's expensive now, but then you're not exposed on these kind of rates for the long haul.
And then in terms of customer deposits and uptake of loans, any trends that you've noticed on those that you'd want to share? Because there's a substantial increase in both.
So I think with the deposits, if rates are going up, which means we are repricing our loan book and new loans as well. The logical thing then is for the customers on the side of deposits, they could see what was happening, of course, with the government papers. And we've seen right now, the regulator has been able to make it very simple for customers to be able to invest in government paper from the comfort of their mobile devices or laptops. We saw customers, of course, investing in the government papers as well. We saw it in the IFB. And of course, then the customers who are putting their deposits, they looked for better rates. And so if you look at our financials, we saw our cost of funds picking up as a result. So there was a lot of preference for savings and term deposits, which came simply because the rates were quite favorable. And then to some extent, also the current accounts also picked up. But the long and short of this is the cost of funds has increased in line with what we've seen on the lending side as well.
And before I come to Ronak, on the uptake of the IFB, what's the interest in terms of foreigners in the IFB, or what are your observations around that, and especially in the local market? Since the IFB, the Kenya shilling has been improving since, and then most of people do attribute it a bit to the inflow foreigners, especially to the IFB. You also spoke a bit about some of those funds which were not able to be channeled to the IFB, entering the secondary market to invest in, or at least to get the IFB in the secondary market. So could you speak to that a bit about the interest in the IFB and what you're seeing, especially from foreign investors, local market, and perceptions around the economy and the outlook for the year 2024?
I think the dark cloud for Kenya, of course, has been the maturing 2 billion euro bond that is maturing in June. That has been really the biggest concern from investors. And the concern came from the default risk, looking at countries like Zambia, Ghana, where we saw the default. And so there was a big concern, investors shying away, and all of these queries on whether the government will make good. The government was able to go into the market, raise about $1.5 billion, literally nearly clearing the $2 billion, shy of about $500 million, which the government can be able to dig into the FX reserves that is held with the government. That gave a lot of confidence to the investors. And you recall that the subscription there was actually at around $6 billion. So the government could have comfortably picked the entire $2 billion to repay the loan that is maturing in June. That sent some confidence to investors. And that was followed closely by the IFB that was open to both local and investors. Interestingly, with the IFB, this was in local currency. So confidence with investors looking at the $1.5 billion that was raised, they came in big numbers. I don't have the details, but it could be as much as 50% of that IFB. And they were literally converting the foreign currency dollars into Kenya shillings. What that effectively did was to supply dollars to the market at a very quick pace within a very short term. We had all of these dollars in the market. And then, of course, we know what happened with the IF significantly oversubscribed. And even today, as we're speaking, the average rate on the IF was around 18.4. Today, that has rallied up so well that IFB right now is trading at around 17. So you can imagine whoever invested in that, they're already in the money. But the fundamental here is the investor confidence. Tied with the investor confidence, supply of dollars. And with that, you can see what has happened to the Kenya shilling. Significantly strengthening to the rates, I think today trading at around maybe 133, 132. From a high of about nearly 60 at the beginning of this year. So all of that comes with investor confidence and the fact that now people can get into our markets, be it the stock market or the money market, with the confidence knowing that when they want to exit, they'll be able to convert that to hard currency.
Thank you on that. Yeah, you can confirm that because the NSE itself is rallying so far this year. I think most of the banks are up, I think, double digits in terms of the share price performance so far this year. Ronak, do you have any questions on those items? Maybe I just picked up or something else that you want to add before I come back to a few items I have in mind, including cost to income ratio.
Just a couple. Maybe let's just start from what he was just discussing on the international money flows coming in. Yusuf, would you be concerned about this type of hot money coming into the market? Because yes, it's great that these flows have come in and they're supporting the shilling, and that's improved the confidence, market sentiments. But at the same time, now the country is hostage to high rates. As you mentioned before, rates are now quite high relative to the last few years. And that's not conducive for the economy in the long term. And the minute we start to bring rates lower, you might see some of these foreign investors taking flight again, which could be problematic for the shilling. So effectively, we're in a catch-22. Yes, it's great in the short term that the flows have come in, but as a result of that, now the country is hostage to high interest rates. Just wanted to get your views on that, and then maybe I'll follow up on the NPL issues as well.
Yeah, I think, Ronak, yeah, that is a topical issue to say, are we solving the problem short term, but then of course finding ourselves with a big debt burden. But the way I look at this is on looking at it from the other side, where the debt burden was increasing without even taking any debt. What I mean by that is any foreign denominated debt, the minute the Kenya shilling was weakening, that debt to GDP was automatically increasing even without getting any additional debt. Containing the effect, the devaluation of the local currency was going to be an important agenda for the government. And you can see even by raising the $1.5 billion, dollars we pay the maturing $2 billion in June, the government got bids up to about $6 billion, but then went for cheaper at that point, relative, because I'm more comparing with what the rates that have been there before. But not exposing, the easier one there would have been then taking the entire $6 billion. But then, of course, you're locked with some very high rates. But paramount in all of this is returning the investor confidence. The market had completely dried up. Interbank was not active at all. Shortage of currency was a big issue in this economy. You can imagine the oil sector was struggling. That's why we had to start the G2G deal. Our millers, for example, anyone who has inputs that they have to import, we've seen that we import significantly food products like wheat, in oil, all those effectively, the prices went up. But even with the high prices, the availability of dollars was not there at all. To an extent, 3 months ago, 2 months ago, you try to go to a bank and you're looking as little as $1 million. To meet your import demand. And you'll be given a program, it will be fixed, you'll be able to get an amount of dollars on a weekly basis. And the amount was small, something like $50,000 in 1 week. So you can imagine if you're looking to get maybe $6-10 million, how long that will be able to take you. So in returning the investor confidence was very important. Responding by raising interest rates, that is a logical thing to contain FX and inflation. And we've seen in all the jurisdictions, that's been the response. So once that investor confidence comes back, which is exactly what has happened now, you've seen what has happened to the dollars, coming down significantly to 130.32 trading today. And today I can comfortably tell you, if you go to the bank and you want to buy $1 million, you will get it within a few minutes. Yet a few weeks, a few months ago, that was unheard of. And now we're starting to see flows coming in the intermarket. So really being able now to open the market. I think what will be fundamental going forward is to make sure then the government is containing the balance of payment, the current account, making sure that all the fiscal measures that have been introduced are able to raise enough revenue. And we've seen that in terms of the taxes. And then good spending habits on the expenditure side, just make sure that you're then getting value from these flows.
Good points in terms of managing the dual deficits, because those had become quite problematic and will determine how sustainable some of the recent changes are. And just to go back to your points on NPLs, I had two questions. Firstly, like you mentioned, you've been at APSA. You joined when they were Barclays, and then obviously they evolved to APSA. One of the things I've noticed in terms of NPLs and provisions is the level hasn't been elevated just in 2023, which you rightly mentioned is being driven by the environment. But if you look at the provision levels at APSA and prior to that at Barclays, they've been relatively elevated since 2016. The cost of risk has consistently been, I would say, in the range of 2 to 4%. So could you maybe just help us understand why APSA and prior to that Barclays, the cost of risk has been relatively high? Because 2 to 4% ratio over a period of 6 or 7 years just doesn't seem very comfortable when you compare to previous historical levels or when you compare to, for example, other APSA subsidiaries across the group. So maybe just help us understand why the cost of risk has been so high for such a long period.
I think this is a very interesting discussion. During the time of Barclays, we used to be accused that our risk appetite was rock bottom relative to what was there in the industry. And I must say at that point in time, that was true. We were risk averse. There are sectors we could not touch, like, for example, SME. And we know SME is a high risk sector, but with some very good margins. Fast track that, we are APSA. We are a new brand. We are open to do business with all the different segment of customers, all the way to SME, and now even to my MSMEs themselves as well. So with that, then, of course, we look at the kind of pricing we're getting. You're able to price for risk. So you're able to charge better rate, which means better revenue, and then manage the risk. What is interesting, if you look at our loan loss ratios through the cycle, I never appreciate the cost of risk in 1 year. You'll always have ups and downs depending on what is happening. Our loan loss ratio for this period is about 2.8%. In COVID times, in 2020, our loan loss ratio was 4.8%. Immediately after that, 2021, it was about 2%. And so what we're always doing is we draw a line over something like 5 years. And if we get our cost of risk, loss ratio being about 2%, then we're happy. That is actually our risk appetite. So if we see our cost of risk is 1%, for example, then it clearly says that we've gone back to being risk averse and not growing on the top line. Those years of Barclays, we were driving our profitability through managing risk aggressively. And so very low impairment levels, not bold in investments, so cost numbers were quite low. And then, of course, when you look at revenue, you're doing single digits, actually low single digits. And still, we were able to grow profit. If you look at our performance last 5 years, our growth is actually top line. If you look at this period, revenue growth at 19%. So even if your loan loss ratio is at 2.8%, you're still getting the return. And we know the 2.8% next year will come down. So through the cycle, we know that we're always within our risk capital.
Ronak, did you have more?
Yeah, just one quick one that dovetails very quickly into the second question I had. So you'll excuse me for this one because I don't have the full IFRS numbers. But when I calculate, you talked about maintaining adequate coverage. When I look at your NPL cover, based on my estimates on the CBK numbers, they seem to have gone from around the 85% mark to around the 60-65% range. Given the environment, don't you think that's low? And does that potentially suggest that you will have to sustain a relatively high risk charge in the current year, just A, to build up the NPL cover, and B, to make more provisions for any further NPLs that may materialize because of the environment?
I think, yes, you're right. The coverage ratio 1 year ago was about 80. In this reporting period, our coverage ratio is around 65%. And we know that precise actually 66%. The reason on this one is, and this is purely looking at the CBK classification, we've downgraded quite a number of retail customer names purely because we don't have security. And this one is purely on the areas of unsecured lending, so deliberately putting them to the NPL. So the NPL numbers have picked up, and I mentioned not just on the personal household, but also on the side of SME. Now, these accounts which we know, after a certain time, macroeconomic conditions improve, you'll find they come back and they make good. And we've seen that over the period. I think COVID was a very good time at that point in time. So we are okay with this. You should be able to see the coverage ratios improving. And today we are holding about how much? About 1.5 billion stock of forward-looking provisions. So if we see stability, hopefully towards the end of this year and then next year, holding all these conditions constant as it is, then you should be able to see an improvement here.
Thank you. Eric?
Right. So cost to income ratio is quite an industry leading around 39.7%. But then you gave a forward guidance of around 45%. So maybe you can reconcile those two for us.
We've always had a target of having cost to income ratio to the mid 40s. Low 40s, even better. But this is a unique situation where it's actually even below 40%. Now, let's say cost income ratio is a story of two sides, so the numerator and the denominator. Revenue, of course, has really supported this improvement in cost to income ratio. But then as we progress, we are quite bold in terms of the investments. You've seen our staff cost picking up. That's why you see the cost at 16%. And we're still continuing to invest in people. And this is really our customer facing colleagues. But then the big area where we are doing investments is actually in technology. So if you're able to see technology costs picking up, if you look at our pillars, our strategic pillars, having a massive investment in digital channels on the side of automation, you should see some costs coming in here. So impressive, really, just looking at these efficiency ratios, but coming out of quite a number of decisions we've done in the past, from restructures, from resizing the branches themselves, lots and lots of automation, to having 98% of customer transactions happening outside the branches. This is what is informing this cost income ratio. But having said that, the appetite is really to have it in the 40s.
And I think you've really given a good segue to the next question, which I had, which is involving around CapEx investments so far that you're making. And perhaps you could also touch on in terms of capital allocation also, in terms of dividends. If I look at the payout ratios before the pandemic, it was around 80%, 64%, 50% maybe at some point. But since the pandemic had been around the 50s, the payout ratio, do you have a target there, or what's your thinking around payment of dividends for shareholders and how they can expect going forward? So CapEx and dividends.
So let me start with dividend. I think our policy is to, as a minimum, to have a payout ratio of about 50%. So if you look at over the years, apart from, of course, the year, that's COVID year. We've managed to maintain this and really even give a higher dividend payout. Our mantra is we look at our dividend linked to capital, and capital, of course, comes the element of the business ambition. And the one that is very relevant there is growth in our RWAs. And with that, then we do sensitivity. We say we want to grow our RWA by 15%. 20%, that is what is in our medium-term plan. But then we try to do sensitivity, put some stress and say grow by 40%. So that informs the decisions that we make on dividend. But I think key for us is sustainability. We make dividend payout that are sustainable to avoid on one year you're giving a big dividend, the other year you're coming down. So if you look at our dividend, it's been quite stable over the years. This reported period, even with our 55% payout ratio, that our dividend increased by 10% compared to the previous year. And really proud this, that is making sure that it's basically good investors. On the side of CapEx, big plan in terms of investment. And this one, we are looking at investments both on the side of the core banking system that we're using, but then also on channels to deliver different propositions to our customers. Today, we have the digital banking app, we call it Simiza, that has been able to serve the mass market. So opening accounts digitally, getting services like savings and loans through the app, no need of going to the branches. We want to increase the capabilities of this app so that then through that, you can be able to sell insurance, you can be able to sell wealth management products and other services as well. So that's going to be big. We are putting ambitious CapEx investment just to make sure that we can be able to do this investment.
Could you talk a bit about the non-funded income trends that you're noticing, and tell us a bit about how your bank assurances and asset management side are also performing in this financial year?
So since we converted from Barclays into Absa, I mentioned that we brought in quite a number of array of services, and our intention is to make sure that we have a one-stop shop for our customers. No need for customers to withdraw their funds to go to another bank to get a service that is lacking with us. So bancassurance doing extremely well. We started our asset management doing extremely well just in this period, growing by 40%. We started our securities business again, and then we've also gone back the custody business. And if you look at this, then it's a holistic array of services that then makes us a complete financial services bank. They are at an infancy. That's why, you know, we are not speaking so much on the absolute and so much on these deltas. In the recent future, what we're going to do is then be very bold in terms of market share. At the moment, we have started the business. Cascade was launched actually just last month. So really starting to pick up on specific customers. But the ambition here will be to gain market share. That will be the driving mantra for all of these subsidiaries. In there, then it gives us a boost on our NFI. During this period, still 70-30. But then in that 70-30, those drop in our trading book revenue simply because of the comments I mentioned on having rates going up, and you find yourself holding securities with lower rates, of course, then you have to do mark-to-market situation on this one. But all the other lines picking up, service and maintenance fee going up, meaning more customers are doing their banking services with us. Areas on risk going up as well means we're doing a lot of trade deals as well. If you look at our balance sheet, anything to do with guarantees, swaps forward, that one picking up as well. Areas to do with this team is the mass market facilities also picking up. The intention on this one, as mentioned, is we are looking at significant investment in the app, and through then we should be able to see the non-funded revenue picking up as well.
Is someone asking if you're back to opening branches and how many you're targeting for this year? Are you more digital or just thinking of opening branches?
Now, that was an interesting question. I have received quite a number of questions on this one, especially after we opened, I think, 2 branches this year, just within the last 2 months, and planning to open more. 3 more are already work in progress, i.e., the refurbishment of these branches are already happening. So we've looked at the customer behavior and also in different counties. We've seen it's quite interesting. There are customers who prefer physical branches, customers who want to interact with a cashier or an RM. We've also seen an interest in counties where we don't have presence, and they're basically saying, we would like to do business with yourself, but we need a branch in this county. And for good reasons, because you're also improving the county. You're doing an investment there. You're creating jobs. So for that reason, we've made a deliberate decision to actually increase our number of branches. At this point in time, I cannot tell you the exact number of branches. This is something that is evolving. But today we have about 85 branches. We could see this maybe going to 100 branches, but really not targeting the number, but actually satisfying a need. That's really our driving criteria. We are looking to open this year maybe around 7 branches. That number can change. That's why I'm not so fixed on the branches. But the reasons I've mentioned are quite valid. Customer who want to literally go into a branch, we can't avoid that. But then the digital channel still continues. The investment in digital channels is big in our CapEx plan. The investment in agency banking is big as well. Today, we have about 700 agents that we are partnering with, and we want to increase this number to the thousands within a very short time. At the right time, we'll come and make an announcement, maybe the next 1 or 2 months, in terms of how we want to expand our agency footprint. But all of this we are doing because one is cheaper when you're doing agency and alternate channels. And 2, on the branches, is to respond to the customer needs. Just to give you an example, initially, we have once the branches contest, we had to open a second big branch in Isili, which was launched a month ago. Today, you go to that branch, it's already full. So it just tells you we are responding to the customer need. We want to open a third branch in Isili. Again, if that need is there, customers are pushing, we'll definitely have to respond to that.
Thank you on that. There are a couple of questions I asked you directly yesterday, so I'm going to repeat them for the benefit of the audience to be able to respond to them. So one is on the loan-to-deposit ratio, it's around 92%, and whether that caps how much you can lend. And then secondly is about the mark-to-market losses in FY23 and whether you expect any reversals in 2024. So maybe you can speak to that, and then we come back to Ronak if you have any questions, and also the audience if you have any questions. You can just DM us. You can also type in your questions just below the pinned tweet, and then we'll be able to read them here. So back to you, Yusuf.
So yeah, so loan to deposit ratio, 92%. The big component on this drive is the split between what is local currency and foreign currency. There's a time we saw an uptick in foreign currency lending. These are low down towards the end of last year, with a preference for customers really to even convert their foreign currency loans to local currency, especially because of the weakening of the Kenya shillings. While if you look at the wrong way risk, which basically means you're lending in foreign currency to a customer whose inflows are in local currency, they feel the brunt of a weakening shilling. But then while we do that for unique customers, ones who can be able to pass that, but we saw them even now moving into converting that into local currency. So that put a strain on our loan to deposit ratio. That's something that you will see changing with now stability in the foreign currency. We'll see the right customers going to foreign currency funded, and you should be able to see an improvement on the loan to deposit ratio. The mark to market loss, this is purely for valuation, our trading book. We had rallied this revenue last year up to the end of the first half. But significant increase in the reference rate, which is a CBR, it meant we lost that rally. If you look at that line on mark to market impact to our trading book, it's still positive. So it's not a loss. But the point here is to say that revenue, the traction that we have gotten up to around June last year, we lost a big portion of that in the second half simply because of the increase in rates, which meant that we had to reverse quite a number of the gates that we had delivered the first 6 months. But overall, it was not a negative thing.
Thank you, Yusuf, for those comprehensive answers. There's a listener called Kevin, who's very appreciative that you came to give us a comprehensive update of the numbers, and he says kudos for our job well done. His question is, on the interest expense on customer deposit, it picked up around 70% year over year. Is there a management target on where the cost of funds should fall at? And then he also wants an outlook on FX income, given the recent development in the FX market. So I think I'd add there, maybe what's your outlook for the KES going forward this year?
It's Kevin, for the sentiments and for this question. Interest expense picked up. That's, if you look at the interest expense line itself, that's quite high. I think it's 65, between 65 and 70. But if you look at the interest income, that picked up as well, 35%. When you look at those deltas, it's a bit misleading, because while one is a big number, the absolute figure is very small. Our interest income is significantly higher, and hence the net interest income was actually a growth of 24%. When we look at the yields, the average yields on lending, which is the best measure you can be able to use, these went up by 2.3%, with an average lending yield for our loans and advances moving up to 13.3%. So that's about 2.5% increment from the previous year. Whereas for the cost of funds, it went up by only 1%. On average from 2.5 to 3.5. Now, 3.5 is within our target. And if you look at the industry, even as more and more banks are releasing their results, you'll be able to see that 3.5 is a very good blended rate for cost of funds, and a number that we have an ambition, as long as we can be able to price correctly on the side of assets. Outlook on FX, I think, to be honest on this one, it depends with the government response in the next few months. Kudos to the government in terms of the measures that the government has taken in the last, call it 6 months. G2G, reducing the demand for loans and reducing speculation, that has improved and given stability on the pump prices. If anything, now we are seeing pump prices coming down because, of course, the FX impact is reducing. Both fiscal and monetary policies, the increase in taxes means the government is in a better position to fund its expenditure. The key criteria here, your guess is my guess, is that the government must put to good use this revenue collection that is coming from hard-earned revenue for Kenyans. Now that we have to wait and see. The monetary policies responding and increasing interest rate, that was timely. It is correct to make that move. However, at the right time, once we have stability, then we should be able to see a drop in these rates and bring in stability and the more required funding. Literally right now, I'd say the government is literally taking the funding, the excess funding in the market. We are lending to the government with all these IFBs, with those very attractive bonds. That crowds out the private sector, but then at the right time, that needs to ease. And I believe that would be the plans in the government. I think the rates, I don't want to speculate on where the dollar will be compared to the shilling, but today at 1.32, the expectation has been we are nearly there. That's the sentiment. We are nearly there. 60, the feeling was that was a very strong dollar. Kenya shilling, of course, was showing that it was very weak. The feeling was that was not the correct rate. 100, 3 years ago, again, that was again too low. And hence this feeling that we are nearly there with the current rates, prevailing rates.
Good sponsor. Ronak, do you have any questions before I come to an audience question and a final question for me?
Yeah, sure. Yusuf, you mentioned margins and rightly indicated your net interest income went up despite the increasing funding costs. The other part of that margin equation I noticed was your lending rates. By my estimates, the average lending rate went up from about 11.9% to somewhere around, I think, 14.5%. Could you maybe just break down that increase? How much of that was just driven by increase in the rates, monetary policy rates by the central bank? And how much of it was driven by maybe potential implementation of your risk pricing model? And just on the risk pricing model, what has it been fully implemented? If not, what the expectation on the yield as you continue to implement the model? Thank you.
I'll broadly say that the increase that we reported during this period to the actual average yield is about 13.3, which is a 2.5% increment compared to the previous year. To a larger extent, this was actually as a result of the high interest rate environment. Big chunk of our book is referenced to the 6-month weighted average of T-bills. And so if the T-bills rates are going up after, say, 1 or 2 or 3 months, you'll find that we have to reprice the book. So if you look at our offer letters to the customer, we use that as a base rate, of course, plus a margin. And so when it changes, when it goes up, we'll give the customer 1 month's notice and price upwards. Equally, when it goes down, we do that. So to a larger extent, it was really driven by government securities. Risk-based pricing, we've started that. I won't be able to say that it's a significant book at this point in time. But what happens in this rate environment with very high interest rates, there are customers who then you're able to say their risk profile is quite low. So even when you're looking at your pricing model, you have to respond to their good rating. How we look at the good rating is using our own internal model. Of course, we have the Forex bureaus. And then, of course, then we can be able to go to individual customers. So this is happening, especially now with these high interest rates. And the example I gave yesterday is for retail customers who are employed. They come to us, they get a loan, their salaries are coming to APSA. 3 months down the lane, they move their salary to another bank. And all they're doing is transferring funds to just meet their debt obligation. These customers, we are aggressively at this point in time repricing. We have given them notices to bring their payrolls back to APSA. Failure to reach that, of course, we are pricing. And it's a very simple metric. The minute someone takes their salaries to another bank, it basically tells you they have one to go and borrow from that other bank again. And someone can play that game. Take your salary to 3-4 other banks. You're getting loans from each of these banks. Of course, your risk profile then worsens significantly. So by repricing, we are literally telling them you need to do the right thing, otherwise you're going to pay for this higher cost of risk.
Any more questions?
No, that.
All right. The question here from a listener is on the previous MD had shared that the target is for Absa Kenya to be a top 3 bank in the near future. Is this still your target? And also in terms of your financial plan for the next couple of years, maybe you can give us a bit of flavor on how the FY23 results sit in terms of the long-term plan that you have. And also if you have any M&A plan in store as you seek growth. And finally, then you can give us a summary of the key takeaways that you want shareholders and investors to remember as we close the spaces today. Over to you, Yusuf.
Yeah, thanks so much. I think we have 1 month in when we're doing our budget. We are in our new strategic period, another 5 years. We completed our last 5-year strategic period in December 2020. So we've entered another 5-year strategic period with some key pillars that speak to each of the three businesses that we are in. So our mantra is very simple. It's market share growth. We moved our market share from about 7.5. It went to 8.5 towards the end of Q3 last year. That market share was above 9%. Our ambition is to push that market share to around 12%. So that means whenever we are putting our budgets for each of these budgeting period, we look at the industry performance and we then target to outperform, i.e. grow faster than the industry. We've managed to do that now for the 3rd year running, including even this one. So once we see all the bank results, you'll be able to see that we are growing faster than the industry. So that's our guidance to. We are now open to M&A opportunities. We were trying to balance looking at some of these opportunities while at the same time separating from Barclays. That separation is behind us now. That landed very well. The brand in Kenya is extremely strong and the sentiment, the association with our customers is growing and customers can see a very big difference between the previous brand and our current brand, APSA. With that behind us, we are open now to M&A. And for us, M&A is both for scale, which means if there are opportunities to acquire banks, both again for areas to do with capabilities, to do with segments or products that we don't have, and also looking at it to grow our subsidiaries, partnerships with fintech, we are really open to business. So you'll see a higher appetite coming from APSA just to be able to manage. Now, I think in terms of just concluding my remarks on this one is a good set of results. This be the 1st year of our next strategic plan, the next 5 years. So year one is gone. We are at a very good base. If you look at the balance sheet where it has picked up, the customer sentiments, the surveys we're getting from our customers, and then the team that we have, which is our strength to be able to service the customers. We have set out our ambition. We put our strategic pillars to be a modern consumer bank, which means we'll invest in on the digital front to be a leading bank in business banking. This is where we house our SME segment. And then on the corporate and investment bank, to be a powerhouse in the region that is actually led through ecosystem. So with all of this, then you'll be able to see we will be pushing to make sure that this segments or businesses able to live to their strategic ambition. And then you see we're investing heavily in the enablers to be able to run this business. Our enablers is digital with three pillars on the digital side, including digitizing our core banking system, our people, which is attracting talent and retaining them. We've been voted the best employer for our second year running, and that is still testament to kind of preference that our employees are able to reflect. And really, lastly, is actually to build on this brand. We have repositioned our brand with two key pillars of empathy, which basically means we listen to our customers. You've seen the tag name, your story, Matt, and really living to that change. And then really listening to our customer, which is with the customer experience.
Thank you so much, Yusuf, for that comprehensive analysis of results and them in perspective in terms of your next 5-year strategic plan. So at this point, I would say thank you so much for joining us. And then I would give you maybe a few seconds to say your closing thought, anything that we may have missed out.
No, mine, I think I'm very appreciative for this forum and the participants, the kind of questions, interactions we've had. Any follow-up questions, any follow-up views, areas where we need to improve, please feel free to share that. And really looking forward to another session when we can be able to share my strategic story.
Thank you. Once again, thank you so much for Absa Kenya and for the CFO for joining us today. And hopefully see you again later with another edition of Mwango Spaces.